Thank you very much. I'm delighted to be back here, particularly delighted to have seen the lovely little exhibition of Spence's drawings and models in Arts A. Very happy to sort of vicariously relive my own student experience, which was not in the 60s, but here at Sussex in the 1970s, where what was on offer, I now realise, was something like a perfect education. The campus was then incredibly beautiful, and it made a deep impression on me and led to my interest in architecture. The images which follow will show you what has been lost in the meantime. Sussex's architecture was a monument to the ambitions of its founders, the high hopes of those days. I can't think of a better way for you to mark this year's anniversary than to restore it properly. Bring back the water. Get rid of those broken down wooden fences. Stop gluing names on buildings. Right, I'll say no more, but get stuck in. Sussex received extraordinary publicity from its inception through to the 1970s and beyond. Journalists in the 60s went so far as to compare the creation of the new universities, Sussex, York, East Anglia, Essex, Kent, Lancaster, and Warwick, with the cathedral building movement of the 12th century. The Guardian wrote that Sussex was, I quote, the finest conception of a university to be launched in our time, describing the flood of light from the great refectory window, in what is now Mandela Hall, originally the refectory, that will come to mean as much as the east window of King's College Chapel, unquote. This is not just journalistic hyperbole, but I think evokes the idealism surrounding the whole Sussex project. Ambitious and costly, the expansion of existing universities and creation of seven new ones in the 60s generated debates about education, about academic structures, about location, campus versus city. Architecture, as the physical manifestation of these structures and concepts, was in the limelight. Just as school building captured the imagination of the 1940s and 50s, so university building catches public interest in the 60s. It's the sense of expanding opportunities generated by new social conditions, the exhilarating sense of tradition being set aside and replaced by something completely new, which placed universities centre stage and made them the key building type of their age. Well, links between the design of these, particularly these new places, and the educational structures which were being devised for them are frequently stressed. Educators and architects very often present their ideas together, and a model, of course, always provides a very good focus for a press conference. You can kind of point out and extrapolate particular details. So at Essex, the architect Kenneth Capon and the Vice-Chancellor Arnold Sloman spoke of the compact urban community. And at East Anglia, the architect Dennis Lasden and the Vice-Chancellor Frank Thistlethwaite talked about extendability, the integrated environment, strata, and the distinctive walkways there as thinking places. These are the residences, this is the teaching wall, and these are the thinking places. But at Sussex, things are a bit vaguer. The Vice-Chancellor, John Fulton, on the right, spoke of interdisciplinarity, and his architect, Basil Spence, there on the left, of intercommunicating spaces. But what I think really united these two individuals was their modernising agenda, their ambition to invent, to reinvent the structure and fabric of a university at mid-century. Other new universities, York in particular, spent a long time working out its plans and briefing its architect. Sussex was different. As the first of the new foundations, and determined to retain its lead over the others, it had to move extremely fast. Well, during the 1950s, university architecture comes off the revivalist perch on which it had sat just before and after the Second World War. And we find the architecture of the civic universities, the 19th century foundations like Liverpool, being satirised in various novels. A novel of 1943 by Bruce Truscott called Red Brick takes a particular shot at the university, clearly the University of Liverpool. The hero of the novel arrives to take up a job at an unnamed university, but I think the description is of the Victoria Building there on the screen. I quote, "I saw in front of me a vast block of red brick buildings ornamented with meaningless and geometrical figures, tapering here and there into ridiculous little pinnacles, looking for all the world like miniature candle snuffers." And a few years later, Kingsley Amis's novel, Lucky Jim, published in 1954, evokes the dull pseudo-Oxbridge world of imitation quads and tweedy dons in a post-war civic university. I think it's probably Swansea, that's where Amis taught briefly at that time. The hero, the eponymous Jim Dixon, rather wistfully imagines having a serious discussion of history, the subject he teaches, with his professor, rather than enduring a tedious discussion of arrangements for a madrigal evening, which professor is fixated on. Well, Basil Spence was one of several architects who pioneered a new approach to university design in the 1950s. He designed glamorous new buildings for cutting-edge scientists recruited to the universities of Glasgow, Newcastle, Liverpool, and Edinburgh. At Liverpool, in fact, here is his perspective of the Chadwick Physics Building. This building attracted much curious attention when it blew up, as a result of a sort of rather premature move into uncompleted premises by the scientists involved. Spence also produced plans for extending existing campuses for the universities of Nottingham, Edinburgh, and Southampton. And these were quite unlike pre-war campus plans, which tend to be organised round a monumental axis with vistas focused on some central building. If you think about the University of London and the way in which it was to be organised around Senate House, that great Portland stone tall building containing the library, that's very much the pre-war model. Spence's layouts combined informal layouts with crisply detailed buildings. In the case of Southampton, the layout was controlled by a 20-foot grid, So there's a kind of hidden geometry organising and controlling the position and the footprint of buildings rather than formal symmetry determining them. And the engineering building, which is there, and the Faraday, the Lancaster Tower there. Another view of the campus, I'll come back to it. The lecture theatre of the engineering building, there in this lovely drawing by Kenneth Brown, features, as you can see, a daring cantilever. And I think this drawing is rather interesting because it suggests very much the kind of old vision of university life encountering the new. There's a bearded professor on a bike there, sort of meandering along, but he's sharing the road with some rather smart cars with ponytailed students with big skirts. It's perhaps a kind of moment of transition, if you like, in the image of universities. And certainly Southampton was somewhere which was delighted to revamp itself and to engage Spence and his partner, future partner Jack Bonington, in laying out buildings on the Highfield campus. This is a view of the side of the Nuffield Lecture Theatre with, in the background, what was then the Arts Building, and in the foreground, a sculpture by F.E. McWilliam. University science and technology had benefited a lot from the 1946 Barlow Report's recommendations, and the gradual expansion of the university sector in the 1950s culminated, as I'm sure you know, in the Robbins Report of 1963, leading to a programme of extending existing universities and creating seven new ones in order to accommodate increased student numbers. The arts and social sciences, as well as the sciences, which had benefited in the 40s, were the new beneficiaries. Interestingly, the seven new universities of the 1960s were actually founded in an attempt to plug the shortfall in places before that report actually comes out. So they actually predate the Robbins Report. Well, the opportunities which all this provided for architects are obvious, but the impulse to innovate is not just focused, I think, on the design of universities and their buildings. There is, in the late 50s, a palpable groundswell of impatience with traditional architecture, impatience with the neo-Georgian and the neo-Gothic revivalist styles, which were associated, rightly or wrongly, with sham and pretension. In the late 1950s, a lively group of students from the Royal College of Art targeted various new buildings which they felt were hideously old-fashioned. They called themselves anti-ugly action, and they demonstrated, held mock funeral processions outside buildings they disliked, and marched in protest. Here they are outside the Kensington Library, built by Vincent Harris in 1955. It's out of sight, but that's what they were protesting against, a new building which was adopting a revivalist style, a neoclassical style. Anti-ugly action objected not so much to ugly buildings as to traditionalist ones. I suppose it's the beginning of youth culture. These events are pretty much coincide with CND and the Aldermaston March. So, you know, it's a kind of another manifestation of impatience, irritation with old ways of doing things. It's partly thanks to this pro-modern groundswell that Spence won a prestigious commission in 1957 to design a new residence for Queen's College, Cambridge, where the anti-uglies were very active. A design by the elderly architect Stephen Dykes Bower, surveyor of Westminster Abbey, for a new residence for Queen's College, infuriated students in Cambridge, where the modernist architect Leslie Martin had taken over as professor of architecture. And the model, which was put on display in the college library of Dykes Bower's strange, overscaled, rather Christopher Wrenish design, was stolen. Students are reputed to have then thrown it into the river. Queen's College decided, rather wisely, that it was time for a different approach, and they brought in Spence. Spence married modern design with deference to Cambridge traditions. The building he designed is raised up on columns, pilotti, to allow views through from the river to the quad and vice versa, and had a wonderful roof terrace. It cradled the ancient bowling green, the pre-existing bowling green, on the river bank. And although it was centrally heated, it provided electric fires in each room. Thanks to an ingenious and perhaps slightly dangerous contraption, these fires allowed students to make toast in time-honoured fashion. They no longer exist, needless to say. At the very end of the 1950s, then, Spence is probably the best-known architect in Britain. His new cathedral at Coventry was rising. He'd been elected president of the Royal Institute of British Architects in 1958, where he introduced things like press conferences in order to publicise the work of the architectural profession, to inform the public about what was being built and why. Given his experience of university design, Spence seemed the obvious choice to design an entirely new university at Sussex. How then did he approach it? Well, the excitement and anticipation surrounding the foundation of Sussex is not just due to the prospect of widening access. In his history of Sussex, Fred Gray points out that Sussex was born free, in inverted commas. Unlike the red brick universities, which had operated under the governance of an older institution and had to have their syllabus approved by that institution, Sussex was granted its own charter and could therefore do what it wished in terms of degree structures and subjects. Educationally and architecturally, it seemed important to differentiate Sussex, therefore, from what had gone before. Here, in a pastoral setting on the Downs, it seemed possible to dispense with the pretension and the sham lucky jimmery of the red bricks. Spence, I think, also wanted to break with the glossy modernism of the university buildings, like those he and his partner had recently designed for places like Southampton. And here I'm going to fly a bit of a kite. Spence was an admirer of the work of the landscape painting of Ivan Hitchens, the best-selling Penguin volume on Hitchens, appearing in 1955, describes the painter's where the painter worked in West Sussex. I quote, "Rippling contours, luscious variety in foliage, exquisite tree forms, the smooth maternal landscape of the South Downs, small lakes and pools vibrating gently under a profound silence, watched over by a garden temple of a lost great house." This relish in the contrast of sunlight and shadow, water and trees, evocation of a lost domain, may perhaps have inflected Spence's approach. His son-in-law and assistant, Anthony Blee, who grew up in Sussex, conveyed to him vividly the character and beauty of this place. And this sense of place is important. Spence had built six schools and was rather critical of post-war school design as often unresponsive to locality. His friend Richard Shepherd wrote that a child moving from a school in Hertfordshire to Derbyshire would probably see no difference. So Spence's decision to limit the height of buildings at Sussex and to use materials like brick and flint there is, I think, part of an attempt to create an architecture rooted in place, to wrap the buildings in its landscape. Well, if you could criticise the schools of the 50s for being rather formulaic, lightly framed, planned to a strict module, similar criticisms might be made of university buildings of that era. Spence is on record as saying that that university buildings, especially ones for the arts, should not resemble offices. He criticised the international style, and Mies van der Rohe in particular, for imposing elegant rectangles irrespective of the site and brief. Here is the central building for the Illinois Institute of Technology in Chicago. When the appointments committee met with Spence, they suggested to him that while the buildings may be modern, the materials should age gracefully and be in tune with the surrounding countryside. These are important cues, I think. Spence's own ground-hugging ideas were overlaid with a tougher family of forms. They signalled the involvement of his young assistant, Peter Winchester, some of whose drawings are on show in the exhibition, and some are different ones I'm showing here. These concept drawings are rather fascinating. They provide a sort of conduit between the approach of an architect, Winchester, who at 23 was only slightly older than the students for whom he designed, and Spence's own approach, his mature approach. Winchester made a significant contribution, I think, to the design concept of Sussex. These drawings, made in June 1959, show vaulted brick buildings riding the contours of the site and organically related to them. All around are the great trees. Arcades appear, derived from the arcaded towns of arcaded squares of Italian towns like Vigevano. They link ranges of teaching buildings with the library and with a great hall, a chapel, and a building which is called at first College House. There's the chapel on the right. Strongly modelled geometrical forms are combined with more conventional ones like arches, buttresses, and spirals. In the Great Court are located a chapel and a hall. Now, something similar had been proposed by Spence for the University of Edinburgh and Southampton, and this bird's eye view of Southampton shows the Great Hall here. Here is the pool next to the Nuffield Theatre, which was built, and the ranges of buildings around it, an idea for a vertical hall of residence not built, senior and junior common rooms here, and the science buildings, which we saw earlier. But this creation of a kind of ceremonial centre with important buildings and water is something that crops up in many of Spence's designs for universities, but often not realised at Southampton, but finally realised here at Sussex. Sussex did not ever, of course, build a hall or chapel, or not anyway in that form, but they do reveal what Spence believed were important elements of university life. His desire to generate drama and a sense of occasion through architecture. And the building which was chosen to start Sussex off was College House, soon to be renamed Falmer House. Fulton was determined to provide a base for students there, as he'd done a few years before when he was running Swansea. A place, he said, where students could be and where they could belong, unquote. Because there were at first to be no student residences at Sussex, this building was to be their home, their university in microcosm. And because there was no library and as yet no teaching buildings, it also had to house those functions too. And I think it's here that you can detect an exchange between Vice-Chancellor and architect. Fulton is determined that Sussex would be the most distinctive as well as the first of the new universities of the 60s. And he encourages Spence to create an architecture of real presence. The building which emerged was an entirely new kind of building, just as was Lasdon's teaching wall at East Anglia. Falmer House is a vaulted structure, as you know, with some vaults filled in with rooms and some left open as terraces, allowing views out into the landscape. And this openness, these voids, are of course inherently flexible. But at the same time, the plan has many of the components of college life. It has a grand galleried dining hall in the refectory. It had common rooms, reading rooms, a debating chamber, leisure rooms, but all realised in a new language of architecture. There's a plan of Falmer House as built, and you can see what the components are. Can you actually see the images? Clearly. Yes. Yes? Okay, fine. Now I'm just kind of peering at those bright lights above. And this new language of architecture, yes, so here we are, the entrance, there's the refectory, the debating hall, the interesting sort of division of the accommodation between kind of student areas, leisure areas, things like table tennis, quiet room and study room, and staff areas. Staff reception room, staff common room, staff quiet room. And they're in a model. So the language is resolutely modern. There are flattish concrete arches and lintels and brick walls in homage to Le Corbusier's most intimate and emotionally satisfying house design, the Maison Jaoul, built outside Paris in the early 1950s. Intriguingly, I think Falmer House may also refer to a more monumental native tradition, the courtyarded houses of the Elizabethan period, entered via a gatehouse. This is something I know that Maurice Howard is a theory which Maurice Howard is keen on, or the great quad at Christ Church, Oxford. Winchester's drawings for this building have a kind of subversive humour. Dons and students swarm all over the buildings. The dons, wearing their mortarboards, peer down from the portcullis-like entrance bridge, part of the Great Arch, and thus they control access to this building. But the prime position is, of course, occupied by students who command the view, not only of the courtyard, but of the entire campus beyond from their common room there. The spaces, both enclosed and open, suggest a dissolution of traditional hierarchies, hierarchical structures with faculty, teaching staff on top, students below. They evoke the social mixing and exchange of views, conversations about ideas rather than madrigal evenings, perhaps, a new sort of university. Space frames were, of course, very fashionable in the 1960s, and they convey the idea of adaptability to future change. This is something which Winchester's generation were very keen on. And I think it's tempting to link the curriculum which was being evolved for Sussex with this, the desire to vault disciplinary boundaries, its encouragement of intellectual curiosity, and its refusal then, if not now, to implement rigid departmental structures. But I think it's important to remember that these ideas were still embryonic at the time when this building was designed and constructed. I think it's also worth saying that Spence's spatial concepts may have been rather different from those of his young assistants. Here a view of what was then the junior common room. He's perhaps more concerned with very tall than with fluid spaces, the great vault of the entrance arch and the high galleried refectory. There's a yearning for traditional grandeur here. Spence, in fact, describes these double height spaces as a rather noble expression of the university idea. And I think this fits with Fulton's ambition to forge what he called a distinctive Sussex esprit, to forge an image which would stay in the minds of its students, and to blow the socks off the visitor who entered Falmer House courtyard, just as in an Oxbridge college, the first quad is the place where you make the big impression. It's the grandest, the most perfect architectural statement. So with Falmer House. All this brings us to what I think was the issue which haunts and makes problematic the relationship between Spence and the Vice-Chancellor. It concerns time. In the years before the Robbins Report, universities were jostling for precedence and for funds. Fulton had made a start which ensured that Sussex would be the first of the new universities. The so-called Shakespearean Seven, a phrase coined by a journalist, but which conveys the sort of jostling for power and rivalry amongst these foundations. In 1963, The Observer printed a verse which goes, "How speaks industrious Warwick, shrewd Lancaster, my noble Lord of York, brave Sussex, ill-starred Kent, ambitious Essex," and it kind of goes on in this vein. So, you know, really making a kind of joke of the way that these vice-chancellors were intriguing and behaving like courtiers amongst themselves to get the favour of not the king, but the University Grants Committee. Sussex has been scheduled to take its first students in 1963, but Fulton agreed to begin a year earlier in exchange for extra funding. But Spence, busy, very busy with the RIBA and its problems in 1959, made quite a slow start. And here begins a conflict between Fulton's need for almost instant buildings and Spence's determination, inspired, of course, by Fulton's ambition, to create an architecture of distinction. It has to be said that the prestige and the glamour attaching to Spence was terribly important for Sussex. But equally, the prospect of beginning a new university with no buildings ready for students worried Fulton very deeply. So there you have the kind of the core of this problem. The construction of Falmer House had been envisaged using solid brick vaults and concrete lintels. This idea is abandoned in favour of a quicker, cheaper system of concrete framing clad with panels of brick. There, rather a wonderful photograph of Falmer House under construction, and there a detail showing you some of these pre-cast units making up the vaults. The vaults are not solid, they're quite thin precast vaults, and they're hung from beams, overhead beams, rather like a kind of coat hanger. This system was employed for the early Sussex buildings, where superb workmanship ensured immaculately smooth brickwork and robustly textured concrete. More conventional kinds of construction were used from 1964 onwards. This photograph shows one of the many photographers bending to take a photograph. Longley, the contractor's board, is still up on Falmer House. People are sweeping the leaves away, getting ready for the students. The physics building, and there a side view of Falmer House with its wonderful crisp brickwork and clean concrete. The physics building was completed with Falmer House in 1962. These are the two first buildings. Very different from the physics building Spence had designed at Liverpool, Newcastle, or Glasgow. Its projecting vault and brick piers cast crisp shadows. It's a kind of majestic colonnade with very deep-set bays stepping up the side of the valley. Sussex's early fame derives in great part from these two extraordinary buildings and their strong presence. Private Eye, which always loved poking fun at Basil Spence, published this rather hilarious spoof in 1963, which really takes issue with the big ambitions of Sussex and the fact that it really only had a couple of buildings to its name by this stage. The idea of a Droitwich University was, I think, much funnier in 1963 than it is now. You may not be able to read it. It pokes fun at Sir Basil. The Chancellor is said to be Eamon Andrews. It picks out the new Professor of History, Professor Ezzy Braggs. It shows hopping across the campus, and it shows, you know, the canteen block, which I suppose was one of the functions of Falmer House, in a kind of sea of chaos, with a good deal of kind of pretentiousness as regards what things were going to be and what they were labelled, what they were called. With lots of overtime and rather heroic efforts by the contractors, these buildings were ready for students by September 1962. In fact, a first cohort of students arrived at Sussex in September 1961, and they were taught and housed in rented accommodation in Brighton. But 62 is, of course, the official beginning. From then on, tension mounts between conflicting priorities. Architectural quality on the one hand, and on the other, economical buildings for increased and increasing student numbers. Spence battles for good finishes and materials and resented the cost limits imposed by the UGC. He writes angrily to the registrar, "Buildings are put up for as little as £3.17 per square foot." That was the UGC ceiling for university buildings, but not permanent university buildings, where the more intelligent members of the nation's youth are brought to the highest standard of learning. And goes on, "Universities must surely enjoy the best of architecture and building which can be provided," unquote. North of Falmer House, he designed a great court fringed by a library, a long reflecting pool, which has since been filled in, the lecture theatre and arts building straight ahead, and the science buildings to the right. The lecture theatres were a particular point of contention. There you can see, in the centre of that drawing, a pair of lecture theatres, butterfly-shaped, with bold concrete cantilevers, which were designed to mark the end of this axis with a flourish. The UGC felt these were terribly extravagant, and a compromise was made with the simpler forms that we see now, and an H-shaped symbol of incompleteness, as Spence called it. But Fulton defended Spence, warning the UGC that any impression of cost-cutting would harm Sussex's reputation. He argued that what he called a substantial prestige element in the design and construction of particular buildings was essential, and he supported Spence's idea of creating a quad at the core of the arts building, what the architect called a cheerful, intimate, yet cloistered space. This marks the end of a sort of honeymoon period in which architect and vice chancellor can invent without constraint, a period in which Sussex's unique academic structure was gestating. It was with the arrival of academics like Asa Briggs and Boris Ford in 1960 that the idea of interdisciplinarity really takes hold, with schools of study and not departments, and multi-subject degree structures encouraging breadth and intellectual adventure. But the architectural implications of this were not always very clear. It's not until the building committee is set up in 1961 that there is a channel of communication between the architects and the academic users of these buildings. Asa Briggs, who'd arrived as professor of history, pointed out that at Sussex, where the emphasis was then on tutorials rather than lectures for teaching, flamboyant concrete lecture theatres might actually send a different message. Well, in response to the UGC's very tough stance on funding and his own increased preoccupation with big projects like designing the British Embassy in Rome, Spence stepped back from very close involvement with campus buildings. Designs for a new refectory and a hall of residence were delegated to other firms of architects, Hubbard Ford and Ronald Sims, who designed the park houses, the original, the halls of residence, which it had been decided to build with money from an appeal, the so-called park houses, completed 64 and 65. But Spence, as consultant, made sure that the buttresses and projecting arch forms on these houses provided consistency. And rather delightfully, these houses are named after the other new universities, York, Norwich, Lancaster, Essex, very much asserting Sussex's first among equals kind of position. But Spence and his assistants were very closely involved in two buildings where UGC constraints did not operate, the Meeting House and the Gardner Arts Centre, both externally funded. Winchester's drawings of 1959 show a pyramidal chapel and a cylindrical hall, their solid geometry countering the lightness of Falmer House. The forms and functions of those buildings evolved and are realised in different ways. A Brighton businessman offered to endow a chapel in 1963. When members of the university objected to this idea, pointing out that Sussex was not a religious foundation, it's not like an Oxford, an ancient Oxford or Cambridge college, Spence rethought his concept. The revised idea was to include a quiet room and a space for interdenominational worship. What was now called the Meeting House was designed and detailed by Spence with Anthony Blee, who were deeply concerned with this building's relationship to its surroundings, both natural and built, as I think you can see from this very fluid sketch. They arrived at a robust form which actually echoes those elsewhere. So the drum-like roof of the debating chamber in Falmer House, the fat curve of the chemistry lecture theatre, Chichester, where we are now, and the circular pool beside the arts building are taken up and echoed in this meeting house with its circular moat. They settled on a drum shape composed of concrete blocks set in a honeycomb pattern, topped, as you know, by a conical roof finished in copper. And the meeting house, whose form suggests chapter house and baptistry, a theatre of debate and modern liturgy, Oast House and Dovecote, accommodates both secular and religious purposes and is separated from the campus by a screen of trees and a reflecting moat. And this beautiful photograph by Henk Snoek shows it, of course, with the long reflecting pool in the foreground. The Gardiner Centre for the Arts, the present-day Attenborough Centre, I guess, although I don't think it's opened yet, designed in tandem with the theatre designer Sean Kenny, contained a single, highly flexible space. That flexibility might have generated a very transparent, glazed facade, but instead Spence designs it as a solid brick form viewed against the clump of trees southwest of the library. So the sketches really convey how terrain and trees are envisaged as a backdrop. He's kind of working almost like a scene designer. Its drum-shaped theatre was fringed by foyer, a gallery, studios and offices. And these drawings suggest the synthesis of landscape and architecture. Buildings are considered in terms of sculptural forms. Now, interestingly, elsewhere, at the universities where he worked in the late 50s, Spence commissioned particular pieces of sculpture from artists whom he admired. This is not the case at Sussex, where the buildings themselves are treated as pieces of sculpture. But beside the Art Centre, Henry Moore agreed to loan a sculpture, Arch, a piece which serendipitously was appropriate to the key architectural motif of the campus. And Spence worked out the best position for it in collaboration with the building committee. There seems to have been a wonderful episode in which balloons were used to kind of mark possible positions of the Arts Centre before finally deciding on it. Features in magazines like The Tatler played a big role in attracting a whole generation of students to come to Sussex. Here, 1964, the J Twins. A journalist dubbed Sussex the university that cabinet ministers' daughters go to, the Withit University. But Sussex's early fame was soon challenged by tougher, more cerebral approaches at other universities of the 60s, where there's often quite an indifference to place and to site. Essex, in particular, where a great sort of piazza is imposed upon Wivenhoe Park and tall residences are constructed, like a kind of Italian hill town. Warwick, where white tile is used in kind of resolute opposition to the leafy Warwickshire landscape and the red earth of Warwickshire. In architectural and planning terms, there's great contrast with Sussex from East Anglia and York. Lasdon's architecture at East Anglia is tough, structurally complex, but revealing of its complexity. The York architect, Stirrett Johnson Marshall, spent 2 years devising his plan, plotting a web of buildings which corresponded to the rather complicated collegiate yet interdisciplinary structure at York. Marshall wrote of the intellectual satisfaction, the beauty of meeting budgets. Spence spoke rather of the beauty of the site and of the architecture. A project of 1964 challenges Spence's concept of the university. This, produced by Cedric Price of Archigram, the Potteries Think Belt project, is, if you like, the very antithesis of what we've been seeing. is designed to transport university facilities to students along a railway network rather than vice versa, a scheme which lacked any strong physical presence. Labs were to be moved by rail, lectures were to be recorded. It's determinedly anti-monumental and transitory. A character in a short story by Saki warns of the dangers of being a pioneer. I quote, "It's the earliest Christian who gets the hungriest lion," he wrote. So Sussex received a bit of a critical mauling from student architects at seminars held in the 1960s. Architectural Association students objected to the appearance of primitive massiveness belying the lightness of the underlying structure. Spence responded that he designed buildings for people, not architects. Elsewhere he writes, "I'm a bit puzzled by this talk of purity of structure. Who is the judge of it? Being a down-to-earth Scot, I feel that all one can ask of structure is that it should be durable, stand up to the ravages of time, increase in beauty with age, bond with the architecture to create a unity, look beautiful, and not be too expensive," unquote. And his emphasis on finish and durability is key, making a pointed contrast to lightly framed, highly glazed post-war school buildings, and with the international style maturing in the 1950s. Sussex, with its handmade local brick, its monumental-looking concrete vaults, is more carefully crafted, more solid, architecturally bolder. This is red brick, but not as it was then known. Sussex is, I think, perhaps a hinge between old concepts of a university and new ones. It combines the gravitas of the ancient foundations with the progressive educational ideas of the new ones. Quads, cloisters, the great refectory combine with modern architectural forms. And Spence's approach to Sussex has quite a lot in common with the grand buildings designed for the new foundations at Oxford and Cambridge at the end of the 50s. So foundations like New Hall in Cambridge or Churchill College, founded at the end of the 50s, which has a giant entrance portico and a dining hall which is 38 feet high, the grandest of all dining halls, the highest of all in Cambridge, old or new. Early articles on Sussex comment on its resemblance to an American liberal arts college, a broad first year of study, the use of the terms faculty, dean, school of studies, major and minor subjects. But there's also a trenchant assertion of the importance of European cultural roots. Spence refers to the buildings arranged around the Great Court, now Library Court, in terms of classical models. The Athenian Stoa of Atticus, the physics building, a Mycenaean treasure house, the library, even the Roman Colosseum, Falmer House. These echo elements of the early Sussex curriculum, which, like the Oxford greats, included classical literature, philosophy, and history. Martin White, one of the founders of the School of European Studies here, refers to that ideal, that now unfashionable ideal, the concept of Britain as part of Europe. In David Deitch's book, The Idea of a New University, White wrote, "Europe is the seat of our civilization. It is ourselves," unquote. And Spence's play on the theme of shared cultural heritage in this connects with this, but also connects Sussex back to Oxford and the tradition of Oxford greats in which Fulton had been educated at Balliol. It also has a political resonance in that Britain was just then attempting to join the European Union, something which de Gaulle foiled and only happened in 1973. Well, with the disappearance of courses like the European Foundations at Sussex and the reduced role of modern languages, the meaning of these symbols and references has got lost. Student law now identifies in the campus plan things like the silhouette of a cat and a box camera. Student life changed dramatically in the 1960s, and Spence's attitude to students also. In 1961, he writes of providing a place which gives the young student confidence to make the transition between adolescent and adult. In 1965, he writes of the need to provide student-proof furniture. That decade turns campuses like Sussex into theatres of protest. In 1968, at the height of the Vietnam War, when students threw red paint over the visiting American ambassador, Spence suggested dryly that a reflecting pool at the bottom of the library's steps might perhaps have a calming effect on the inmates of Sussex. It suggests the widening gulf between Sussex's rather stately beginnings, rather portentous beginnings, and wilder styles of student life in the 1960s. But Spence's legacy does not only lie, I think, in a set of distinguished buildings, but in the creation of grand ceremonial spaces. The Great Court, Library Square, provides the setting for the annual dissertation dash, but also for more serious activities. Successive generations of students have put the ceremonial centre which he designed to very good use, taking possession of the Great Court outside the library. Just as in 1968, so in 2008, here, no redundancies, on the arch leading into Falmer House, and in 2010, when it became a theatre where profound changes to the academic structure of Sussex were debated and talked about. These images reached a very wide audience via the web and social networking sites and via a rather wonderful podcast made by students. And I suspect that Spence would have been rather pleased by this creating appropriation of these spaces. Thank you very much.